The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's stories include Dems push $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill through Senate, and NC schools will share $1.6 billion in COVID relief aid, how they can use it. An exhausted Senate narrowly approved a $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill Saturday as President Joe Biden and Democratic lawmakers notched a victory they called crucial for hoisting the country out of the pandemic and economic doldrums. After laboring all night on a mountain of amendments, nearly all from Republicans, and rejected, bleary-eyed senators approved the sprawling package on a 50-49 party line vote. That sets up final congressional approval by the House next week, so lawmakers can whisk it to Biden for his signature. The huge measure, its total spending is nearly one-tenth the size of the entire U.S. economy, is Biden's biggest early priority. It stands as his formula for addressing the deadly virus and a limping economy, twin crises that have afflicted the country for a year. This nation has suffered too much for too long, Biden told reporters at the White House after the vote, and everything in this package is designed to relieve the suffering and to meet the most urgent needs of the nation and put us in a better position to prevail. Saturday's vote was also a crucial political moment for Biden and Democrats, who need nothing short of party unanimity in a 50-50 Senate they run with Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote. They have a slim 10-vote House edge. Not a single Republican backed the bill in the Senate or when it initially passed the House, underscoring the barbed partisan environment that so far characterizing the early days of Biden's presidency. Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican from Alaska, missed the votes to attend his father-in-law's funeral. That gave the Democrats a one-vote edge in the Senate. A small but pivotal band of moderate Democrats leveraged changes in the legislation that incensed progressives, not making it any easier for Speaker Nancy Pelosi from California to guide the measure through the House. But rejection of their first signature bill was not an option for Democrats, who faced 2 years of trying to run Congress with virtually no room for error. They feel like we do. We have to get this done, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, said of the House. He said he'd spoken to Pelosi about the Senate's changes and added, "It's not going to be everything everyone wants. No bill is." The bill provides direct payments of up to $1,400 for most Americans and extended emergency unemployment benefits. There are vast piles of spending for COVID-19 vaccines and testing, states and cities, schools and ailing industries, along with tax breaks to help lower-earning people, families with children, and consumers buying health insurance. The package faced solid opposition from Republicans, who called it a wasteful spending spree for Democrats' liberal allies that ignores recent indications that the pandemic and the economy could be turning the corner. The Senate has never spent $2 trillion in a more haphazard way, said Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky. Of Democrats, he said, their top priority wasn't pandemic relief. It was their Washington wish list. The Senate commenced a dreaded vote-a-thon, a continuous series of votes on amendments, shortly before midnight Friday, and by its end around noon, had dispensed with about three dozen. The Senate had been in session since 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Friday. Overnight, the chamber was like an experiment in the best techniques for staying awake. Several lawmakers appeared to rest their eyes or doze at their desk, often burying their faces in their hands. The measure follows five earlier ones totaling about $4 trillion that Congress has enacted since last spring and comes amid signs of a potential turnaround. Vaccine supplies are growing, deaths and caseloads have eased, but remain frighteningly high, and hiring was surprisingly strong last month, though the economy remains 10 million jobs smaller than its pre-pandemic levels. The Senate package was delayed repeatedly as Democrats made an 11th-hour change aimed at balancing demands by their competing moderate and progressive factions. Work on the bill ground to a halt Friday, and after an agreement among Democrats on extending emergency jobless benefits, seemed to collapse. Nearly 12 hours later, top Democrats and West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, perhaps the chamber's most conservative Democrat, said they had a deal and the Senate approved it on a party-line 50-49 vote. Under their compromise, $300 weekly emergency unemployment checks on top of regular state benefits would be renewed with a final payment made September 6. The Senate voted Friday to eject a House-approved boost in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025, a major defeat for progressives. Next, NC schools will share $1.6 billion in COVID relief aid. How can they use it? North Carolina Public Schools will share $1.6 billion in federal aid designed to help them to deal with issues related to the coronavirus pandemic. The State Board of Education approved Thursday a policy for distributing $1.6 billion in federal COVID-19 school relief aid. The State Department of Public Instruction will keep up to 10%, with school districts and charter schools getting the rest of the funding. This is obviously a significant distribution of funds, said State Board Vice Chairman Alan Duncan. It's the latest in a series of relief packages approved by Congress over the past year. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system will get at least $141.9 million, the most of any school district in the state. The amounts are based on the number of low-income students in districts and charter schools. The Wake County school system will get the second highest amount of at least $96 million. The minimum amounts for other Triangle school districts include Durham Public Schools, $46.6 million, Johnson County Schools, $29.2 million, Chatham County, $5.4 million, Orange County, $3.7 million, Chapel Hill Carrboro, $3.2 million. Schools will have to apply to the State Department of Public Instruction, showing how they intend to use the funding. The money can be used for a variety of reasons, including providing principals and other school leaders with resources to address the needs of their individual schools, purchasing sanitation and cleaning supplies for school facilities, purchasing educational technology for students, providing mental health services and support, addressing learning loss among students, planning and implementing summer learning and after-school program activities. The State House passed legislation requiring school districts to set up a summer school program to help students who've had learning loss due to COVID-19. The Senate has not yet acted on the bill. House Speaker Tim Moore said districts can use this new round of federal aid to fund the summer program. Next, General Assembly bill would slow federal rental assistance, state official says. A bill in the state legislature that would impose administrative restraints on federal rental assistance would make disbursement of the aid slower, a state official said. The bill would cap rental aid in each county based on population and median income. It would also cap administrative cost, which includes salaries for case managers, at 5%. The federal government set the maximum for each state at 10%. Laura Hogshead, Chief Operating Officer at the State Office of Recovery or Resiliency, or NCORR, told the NNO in a phone interview that these county caps would unnecessarily slow down the process of getting funds to tenants who have fallen behind on rent due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Inevitably, we're going to have to slow down applicants from one county in order to make sure that another county is getting up to their number, Hogshead said. It's going to kill the program. The State Housing Opportunities and Prevention of Evictions Program, or HOPE, has operated statewide under NCORR to provide rent assistance to tenants and landlords since it was created back in October. Hogshead said that H-196, which passed the State House and Senate on Thursday, would essentially require the HOPE program to maintain 100 smaller rental programs, one in each county. It will be chaos, which is the last thing we need in a program that folks are really counting on, Hogshead said. She said state legislators had not consulted NCORR when writing the bill. In an email statement to the NNO from Roy Cooper's office, Press Secretary Dory McMillan said legislative leaders should have consulted state programs before writing budget changes. County caps will slow down aid while preventing some people from getting it in harder hit areas. The governor wants low-income renters to get help quickly, and he will ask the legislature to revisit this issue, McMillan said. Cooper's office did not respond when asked if the governor would consider a veto. The bill, which also allocates funding to other emergency assistance programs, did not receive any no votes in the state legislature. The federal COVID stimulus from December allocated $546.5 million to North Carolina to be used on a statewide level. In late February, the U.S. Treasury issued guidance that dictated that the rent assistance must go to households at or below 80% of the area median income. Republican Senator Ralph Heiss wrote the county cap provision in the bill. It's about delivering these funds where the need is across the state. And yes, that's going to require work, Heiss said in an interview with the NNO. I cited a provision in the bill that allows NCORR to show that a certain area needs more funding, but he said that has to be done through the General Assembly. We would then be able to redistribute those funds back to other counties where they have need, but they need to show us that it's happening right now, I said, not that they just took the funds and said, where's the easiest place to put them? Hogshead said the HOPE program already screens based on median income and only accepts applicants who earn 50% or less of the median income in each county. Of the 42,000 applicants to the HOPE program, over 90% were at 50% or below the median income, Hogshead said. As for the 5% limit on administrative cost, Heiss said the federal guidelines are a maximum and the limit was put there to have more funding for tenants. It is more important that these funds go to help people in need, Heiss said. Or is it more important that we've made sure that the administrative process in Raleigh is as funded as it would like to be? Without the extra funding, Hogshead said, she's concerned there won't be enough money to hire caseworkers to meet the demand in the state. As a central unit, we're going to have to lean more on counties, and I fear that that would mean they would have to go into their own budgets, Hogshead said. When the HOPE program started in October with $167 million allocated from federal stimulus, it took about a month and 42,000 applicants for NCORR to halt the program due to lack of funding. Since the program stopped accepting applications, $70.3 million of the $139.3 million awarded 36,346 households has been given out as of Thursday morning. Hogshead said NCORR is waiting for necessary information from tenants, landlords, and utility providers before it can distribute most of the rest of the money. About $6 million needs to be processed on NCORR's end, she said. Hogshead encouraged those waiting for money to check for emails from NCORR. Samuel Gunter, executive director of the NC Housing Coalition, a nonprofit affordable housing advocacy organization, opposes the provisions in H-196. He told the NNO in a phone interview that the most important thing right now is speed. When we come down with resources, we want to attach all of these strings and make it very difficult for individuals to access it, Gunter said. It becomes incredibly difficult for folks to access the help they need in a timely manner. Next, the jobs the pandemic may devastate. Projecting how many people will work in hundreds of detailed occupations in 2029 is a bold exercise, even without the uncertainty of the pandemic. But labor experts within the U.S. government tried to do just that. And their latest assessment of which jobs will grow over the next decade has alarming implications for jobs requiring less education, while also forecasting a boom for health researchers and other health science jobs. That assessment from the Bureau of Labor Statistics emphasizes all the uncertainty that accompanies projections, and it stresses that these are estimates of structural changes, not forecast of cyclical booms and bust. Long-term projections are often wrong, especially for more volatile sectors like mining and construction, but the agency's estimates are typically well-reasoned and sober. The original BLS projections made last year without taking pandemic effects into account called for a cumulative economy-wide job growth of 3.7% from 2019 to 2029. The new pandemic-informed projections cut that to 2.9% in the moderate impact pandemic outlook and 1.9% in the strong impact one. Both of these new outlooks assume more remote work and higher demand for relevant technology services, less in-person entertainment and travel, and more investment in public health than would have happened without the pandemic. In the strong impact projection, there would be 25% more public health researchers in 2029 than the original baseline projection for 2029, the largest increase among nearly 800 detailed occupations. The 100 occupations with the biggest increase in projected employment relative to the baseline projection are all in medical, health science, and technology fields. The 10 occupations with the largest declines relative to the baseline projection include restaurant, hotel, and transportation jobs. On balance, the new projections modestly speed up the occupational shifts from the original baseline projections. For instance, the pandemic is poised to accelerate the originally projected fast growth in software developer jobs and to hasten a previously expected decline in cashier jobs. The projected employment changes because of the pandemic are concentrated in a relatively small number of sectors. Three-quarters of all jobs are in occupations where projected unemployment in the strong impact scenario differs from the original baseline scenario by less than 2%. For the most part, the sectors originally projected to grow fastest over the next decade in the baseline projection, like nurse practitioners, home health aides, and many other health care occupations, are still projected to grow fastest. Similarly, the sectors originally projected to shrink most, such as administrative assistants, mail carriers, product inspectors, are still projected to decline similarly in the pandemic-affected scenarios. Across all occupations, the correlation between employment growth in the original projection and the strong impact pandemic projection is 0.92. A correlation of 1 represents a perfect relationship, and 0 represents no relationship. The sectors facing additional job loss because of the pandemic are low-wage sectors where workers are already struggling. The strong impact pandemic projection shows the lowest paid occupations losing jobs over the decade. This would be a significant shift from the original pre-pandemic projections, in which growth was the greatest in the highest and lowest wage occupations, with middle wage occupations lagging. The pandemic could end up replacing polarized growth with a net loss of lower wage jobs. Grouping occupations by educational requirements instead of wages tells a similar story. For jobs requiring a bachelor's or a graduate degree, projected upbeat employment growth remains nearly the same under the pandemic-affected picture as in the original baseline. The decline in projected employment growth because of the pandemic is almost entirely concentrated in jobs requiring only a high school diploma or no diploma. The pandemic makes forecasting a risky business. Near-term projections of gross domestic product or unemployment hinge on things like the rate of virus mutations and vaccine distribution. Longer-term predictions depend on how much of the pandemic permanently changes how we work and spend. But the pandemic has already widened existing inequalities. These new projections suggest that the unequal effect on jobs could long outlast the pandemic. And next, the boredom economy. Mark Hawkins is an expert on being bored. When he was getting his counseling degree, he was fascinated by articles on the therapeutic benefits of boredom. He has written a book whose title is The Power of Boredom. In his spare time, he likes to sit on his couch and stare out the window. "It's very difficult, but I do try to be bored as much as possible," he said in a recent interview. Yet during the pandemic, even Hawkins, who lives in British Columbia with his wife, has at times gotten bored of being bored. Desperate for some stimulation, he has turned to Amazon, where he orders mainly books, like Ursula K. Le Guin's translation of the Tao Te Ching and the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. "I'm getting things delivered within a few hours of ordering them," Hawkins said. "In terms of how it's affecting the economy, we are wanting to buy more and more and more because a lot of us are bored at home, so we're online shopping." There are many readily available ways to assess how the coronavirus pandemic has affected the economy. The pandemic has decimated the labor market, driving the unemployment rate to 6.3% in January, nearly twice what it was a year earlier. Restrictions on activities led Americans to spend less money, pushing the savings rate to extraordinary heights. As people have fled to places with more space and fewer people, home prices have surged. Another way the pandemic has had an impact on the economy is by making people bored. By limiting social engagements, leisure activities, and travel, the pandemic has forced many people to live a more muted life without the normal deviations from daily monotony. The result is a collective sense of ennui, the one that is shaping what we do and what we buy and even how productive we are. Because we're spending so much time in the home, we're investing more in the home, said Marshall Cohen, the chief retail analyst at NPD Group, a market research company. And the thing that we're investing in are things to keep ourselves busy. Boredom's impact on the economy is under-researched, experts say, possibly because there has been no modern situation like this one, but many agree that it is an important one. How people spend money is a reflection of their emotional state. The answer to how are you in Amazon packages and Target receipts. The Consumer Confidence Index is an economic indicator that in part gauges optimism about the future. A related measure that might help predict market volatility or home improvement trends, a boredom index. Among the most vivid recent examples of boredom's economic influence occurred late last month when amateur traders, many of them followers of the Reddit forum Wall Street Bets, piled into shares of GameStop and a down-for-the-count retailer for gamers. These investors pushed its stock to astronomical highs before it crashed back to earth. Part of their motivation was the idea that they could stick it to hedge funds, which had bet that GameStop would fall. Part of it was boredom. I'm bored. I have $8,000 in free money. What can I invest in that will make it at least a little profitable? A Reddit user who goes by Bigid42069 wrote on Wall Street Bets at the height of the stock market frenzy. The response was unanimous. GameStop. On Thursday, the House Financial Services Committee held a contentious hearing on the GameStop saga, and the focus was on market volatility and stock trading. But some witnesses acknowledged that they may have found themselves in this situation simply because people had a lot of time on their hands. We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Money Matters is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.